It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, politicians are now weighing in on the debate over whether or not to vaccinate. We'll talk about the debate over public health and personal choice.
First, along with eating well and exercising, it might be time to add writing to your health and wellness program. New research shows that writing doesn't just reduce doctor visits and improve memory. It can also lead to behavioral changes and improve happiness.
The idea goes like this. We all have stories that we tell ourselves about our lives, but they may not always be accurate. By writing stuff down, we can see things more clearly and find solutions, maybe even change the narrative. For example, instead of seeing ourselves as someone with bad luck, we can write ourselves as someone who overcomes hardships.
Timothy Wilson joins us now. He's a professor of psychology at the University of Virginia and the author of Redirect, Changing the Stories We Live By, which is just out in paperback. Timothy, welcome to Central Time.
Great to be here. Thank you, Veronica.
Well, could you start us off by telling us about a study that you did at Duke University where students who were struggling used writing, some of them, to get out of their slump?
Well, this is kind of what got me into this whole area. Years ago, I did this study where, like most college professors, I noticed that first-year students often struggle. They've done very well in high school, but then along comes that first test, maybe in calculus or psychology, and they get a bad grade. Well, what happens next depends very much on what the story is they tell themselves. It could be a very pessimistic story that they're just not cut out for college, and that's going to confirm itself because if that's what they think, they're not going to study and they'll keep doing poorly. Or they could tell themselves a more positive, optimistic story that, hey, this is a wake-up call. I just need to figure out the ropes here. So our study basically tried to change that story from the negative to the positive one, and we did so by bringing them in and just for about a half hour giving them some statistics showing that grades get better after the first year, and then we had them watch some videotaped interviews of older students who reinforced that message. And lo and behold, that 30-minute little what I call story editing intervention led them to do better in their courses. They got better grades over the next year compared to a control group, and they were more likely to stay in college.
Okay, so how can we replicate that same idea with writing? You used videos and some testimonials. How do we do it by ourselves with writing?
Sure. Well, I think there's several ways we can try to change our own stories, but there are these really great writing exercises that social psychologists have developed. And they're best used when, you know, maybe there's something that's troubling us we can't quite seem to get beyond, maybe a argument we had with someone or something that happened to us. And it turns out that just taking out a piece of paper and maybe two or three nights in a row for about 15 minutes writing about our deepest feelings about this incident, opening up is a way to... What really it seems to do is to get people to view it in a different light. They find a better story, if you will, to explain what happened to them. And one particular technique that researchers have looked at recently is to write about ourselves from a third-person perspective, as if we were a fly on the wall. That seems to be better than... say we had an argument with someone and we want to write about it. It's not so great just to rehash it and say, well, I said this and then she said that and we just kind of re-experience the bad feelings. But if we pretend we're a fly on the wall looking at this from a third person perspective, sometimes they recommend we even use our own names as if we were writing about someone else. So I would say, well, Tim did that, and then Tim did this, and that gives us a little distance and makes us view it in a way that often allows us to move on.
So let's say you write it down, you use the third person as you just did in that example. How then do you get to the conclusion part? Do you read it over? Do you ruminate about it? How do you get the most out of what you've just written?
Well, it seems that it's the act of writing that triggers this new meaning, that you don't really have to go back and read what you write that much, is what the studies tend to show. You know, I think any writer will tell you that the act of writing is a creation. It just the act of putting, pen to paper or fingers to the keyboard, I guess, is a way to make us look at things differently than we did before.
Is this kind of the same thing as journaling?
Well, it could be. But I think what prevents us from doing it is we don't want to focus on the things that trouble us. It can be painful to do so. And indeed, the researcher who really pioneered this technique, a guy by the name of James Pennebaker, he found that when he asked people to do it, they'd often become upset in the moment. Sometimes they cry. And I think that's why we tend to avoid it. It is hard to confront these things. But by so doing, we can move on and get beyond it by finding new meaning in these events.
Can this be used for someone who's maybe experienced an acute trauma, a specific traumatic event that they need to be able to reframe and move past?
Well, what I think the research shows is don't do it too soon. That indeed, some of the techniques that are used to help people who witness terrible things, ask them to, as soon as possible, to relive them. And I think that's a mistake, because if we relive an event too soon, it actually can imprint those events in our memories. So I think the best advice is to let some time pass, see how we're feeling in a couple of weeks, say, and then take out that piece of paper and give ourselves a little distance to write about it. Now, of course, I assume it goes without saying that if someone is in serious distress, you know, then they should seek help. And sometimes psychotherapy is called for, and that's a good thing. But if it's something that we can just let stew a little while, get a little distance from, then do the writing.
So to get us motivated, what are some of the most dramatic benefits that you've seen from doing this practice?
Well, do you mean me personally?
Stories of people you may have come across.
Yeah, well, I think from the research studies, and again, a lot of these are by James Pennebaker at the University of Texas. He has had people everywhere from Holocaust survivors to people who have had severe traumas, to all sorts of the terrible things life can deal us. And again, as long as people have a little distance from it, it seems to prevent them from ruminating so much about these events and leads to better health. I'm not going to claim this is a magic bullet that works for everyone, but I think it's really worth a try just to force ourselves to find new meaning in these events.
Given what you've seen in terms of the research, would you recommend that we take this up as a daily habit, or is this something you should just pull out of your bag of tricks when you need some help?
Well, it really depends on the person. I mean, some people love keeping journals and write a little bit every night, and I think that's great. I'm not such a person. I'd rather read a book at night. But I think, the times I've done this personally, it's taken some effort. I really had to force myself to write about something that's troubling me. But when I do, it seems to help.
Well, Timothy, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome. Great to be here.
Timothy Wilson is a professor of psychology at the University of Virginia and the author of Redirect, Changing the Stories We Live By, which is just out in paperback. As the measles outbreak sickens more than 100 people across the country, and in Mexico there's been renewed debate over the right of parents to opt out of vaccinating their children.
Now politicians are weighing in. President Obama has said parents should get their kids vaccinated. Republican Governor Chris Christie of New Jersey said parents should have a choice about whether to vaccinate their kids. And Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky said most vaccines should be voluntary and that vaccines can cause, he said, profound mental disorders in healthy children.
Faced with the decision about whether or not to vaccinate, parents confront a bit of an ethical question when that weighs personal choice against public health. Dr. Art Dersey joins us now. He's director of the Center for Bioethics and Medical Humanities at the Medical College of Wisconsin. Dr. Dersey, thank you for joining us.
Good afternoon, Pranika.
Well, vaccination has been a very controversial topic for years, and it's come to a head once more over this measles outbreak at Disneyland. Why is the topic of vaccination still so contentious today?
Well, I actually think it's more contentious than it was in the past, and I think it's due to a number of factors. One is that back in the day, and I have to say that I'm old enough to remember this, that you saw kids and adults who had polio before the vaccine was developed. You saw people who actually had significant debilities as a result of encountering contagious diseases that at the time were seen as a scourge. And when vaccinations were developed, it was seen as something that was wonderful, and parents lined up to have their kids vaccinated against polio and other diseases because they wanted to be first in line to have their kids build up immunity to these diseases. So things have changed significantly. We, you know, are in a way hoist on the petard of our own success because parents don't see that anymore. And in fact, many adults have not seen cases of measles, although those of us who are older remember that many of us got measles. Now that there is a vaccine and we can prevent it, this is something that is available and a really good thing, I would not only argue but maintain. And at the same time, parents who've never experienced measles go, oh, you know, like, why should my child have to have this shot? Because I've never seen a case, and they live a healthy lifestyle, and, you know, they're not going to have anything bad happen to them. So I think that has changed in that way. And then, unfortunately, there was a study that is now a very small study and one that has been debunked over and over and over again. The study was retracted from the British Journal that published it, and the individual was lost his license to practice in Great Britain because he essentially found a link, and turned out it wasn't a finding at all, between the MMR vaccine, measles, mumps, and rubella, or German measles, and autism. And that spread like wildfire, and people believed it. And unfortunately, after study showed that this was not connected, and many experts and most leading people who speak on it, even from a political view, know that this was a study that was invalid, and the data was not reliable at all, and in fact, in some parts was made up. Turns out that that became a folk myth, and people went, oh, I know that this caused the autism in my child, or I heard about this study. And the problem, of course, is autism develops about the same time as these vaccinations are given, and so if you get a vaccination or give a vaccination to a child and anything happens afterwards, you go, oh, well, must be because the child had this vaccine.
So it's a mistaken cause and effect kind of thing.
Exactly, and not everything is cause and effect. And unfortunately, there have been some public figures who are well-known in the celebrity world who go, don't care what the experts say, I know what happened to my child, and this caused it to my child. And so the fact of the matter is that it has become a very hot topic. Oddly, it's not necessarily a political topic. That is, you know, both President Obama and Governor Walker say, get your kids immunized. This is this kind of thing that is straightforward. The science is good, and this is really good for your kids.
But then, on the other hand, you had Chris Christie and Senator Rand Paul saying, you know, they're a little less sure about it, especially
Rand
Paul.
And you also have folks who live in Southern California, which probably tends to vote more on the Democratic side, saying, you know, we're just not going to do it because, you know, we're going to go with other approaches to make sure that our children are healthy. And in fact, Southern California has some of the highest rates of, or lowest rates of vaccination, highest rates of kids who are unvaccinated, hence the Disney outbreak, and hence a lot of other outbreaks, because there are kids who are not getting vaccinated. And sadly, you need, under the theory of so-called herd immunity, which basically says if you think of human beings like a herd, if enough people are vaccinated, even if one person gets the disease, they're not going to encounter another person who's not vaccinated, and so it's not going to be passed along. Once you drop below a certain number, and it depends upon the disease what that percentage is, but with measles, people are in agreement that it's in the mid-90s that 19 out of 20 kids need to be vaccinated for something not to be passed along by the one who's not vaccinated, when it drops below that, then the disease can spread. And we've gone from a time when measles was extremely rare to when measles was in the double digits and now in the triple digits of kids who have it. And it is a disease that does have a small percentage of mortality. That is, kids don't die from being vaccinated against measles, mumps, and rubella, but they do die if they do get it. And the fact is that worldwide, there are thousands of children who die. In the United States, it's about 1 in 1,000 who get it that die, but we haven't reached that, you know, those kinds of numbers. But when we do, children will die from measles.
Now, I want to go back to your earlier point about parents not being able to see the disease. They don't see it, you say, and so all they know is that their kid has to get this shot, which is going to affect the child's immune system somehow. And there's competing information out there, as you say, that persists today. Do you think that the fact that these diseases aren't right there before parents' eyes, before the world's eyes, as much as they used to be, as in your example of polio, that this is sort of a breeding ground for misinformation and for fear?
I do believe that. And unfortunately, there is not a way to mandate that children be vaccinated unless you mandate that for attendance at school. But parents are, in general, making decisions about this for their children. And even though I think every pediatrician, every infectious disease specialist, every emergency physician knows that this is a very important act in keeping your child healthy, the fact is that until they have to do something like go to school, you know, or want to go to a camp somewhere, they aren't required to be immunized. That is, we don't, you know, require parents to do it. On the other hand, if there is an outbreak, they might be isolated and quarantined if they have the disease or if they're infectious. And unfortunately, measles is in this category where at the time that they're infectious, they're not badly sick. So there are some diseases like Ebola in which you are infectious at the point at which you're really, really sick. And so physicians and nurses often are able to make decisions about whether or not someone should be quarantined. And, you know, there was the case of the nurse who came back who, you know, apparently was doing well, but there was a period of time where they wanted to make sure that she didn't have the disease. But because she was not ill, it was unlikely, highly unlikely that she had it. With measles, kids can have it and spread it to other kids before they get sick. So the problem is especially the case that we may not know when a child is spreading the disease. I'm sure all the kids in the Disney example were feeling fine at the time that they encountered each other, and only later when they were further along in the disease that they essentially started showing the symptoms. So this is another reason why immunization is important, is that even if a parent says, yeah, well, when my kid gets sick, I'll pull them out of school, they won't affect anybody else, and I'll just let them get the disease, they've probably already infected other kids. The infectivity of measles, by the way, is much higher than something like Ebola or other diseases because over 9 out of 10 kids who have contact with another person who has measles in the development and spreading stage will develop it. So it is a highly contagious disease, highly infectious disease.
Now right now, it's being framed more or less as a public health versus personal choice question, and the people who choose not to vaccinate feel that is within the purview of their choice. Sometimes it's a religious belief. Do you think this is the right way to frame the conversation about vaccination?
Well, I do think that the balance here is between, you know, individuals' rights to be free from unwanted treatment that they may have and other individuals' rights to be free from infection from people who have it. To use an example, if someone has tuberculosis and amazingly they themselves are not suffering from any particular bad effects from it, but they're spreading the disease like, you know, wildfire, we will put that person either under quarantine or, if they violate it, even confine them against their wishes while they're mandatorily treated to be able to prevent them from passing the disease on to other people. So the danger that they pose to other people as a result of this infection limits their choices in life. And actually, we've had a few cases of TB where TB was spread with someone who was even told that they were positive and told to stay home and to accept treatment. And the individual said, well, I'm going to a wedding, you know, so flying out of the country, out and back to go to that because nothing's going to stop me.
We'll come back and pick this up after the news. We're talking right now with Dr. Art Dersey about the challenges and the potential consequences of choosing whether or not to vaccinate children.
And we want to hear from you. Do you think parents have an ethical obligation to get their kids vaccinated, or should we look at this as a personal choice? Are you worried about what could happen if more people choose not to vaccinate? Call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking with Dr. Art Dersey, Director of the Center of Bioethics and Medical Humanities at the Medical College of Wisconsin. We're weighing the possible public health consequences that result when we make the individual choice not to vaccinate our children.
We invite you to join the conversation. Where do you stand on all this? Should parents be required to vaccinate their kids? Should it remain a personal choice? Weigh in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Dr. Dersey, but before we went to break, you were leaving us with some thoughts. Did you want to continue?
Well, I just wanted to compare this outbreak to something like someone with tuberculosis. At some point, and I don't know what that point will be, the public health concerns start to outweigh the individual choice concerns. And especially when, you know, either when there is an epidemic or when there's an active infection, both of those, the public health concerns is essentially how do we prevent other people from being harmed by this individual's disease or infectivity. And so, you know, I do think that it is a balancing. It's a balancing of individuals' rights to be free and to make these choices against the rights of other people to both be healthy, protect their children, and in the case of at least one individual whose daughter has a deficient immune system, he's asking the school to require that students be vaccinated against measles because his daughter can't protect herself by getting an immunization. So he's actually asking for people to think about her vulnerability because it's not a personal choice for her. She can't get the vaccine, and other kids, by not getting the vaccine, put her at risk.
Let's go to our callers now. I've got a lot of folks waiting to talk to you at 800-642-1234. We'll go first to Jan in Ashland. Hi, Jan.
Hi. I'm not against immunizations, but nowadays it's not just measles, and that's German measles. It's mumps, rubella, common measles, chickenpox, polio, whooping cough. They're given to 7-pound, 8-pound babies, and the insurance companies expect these to be given all in one appointment so that you don't drag it out to several appointments. I know a lot of young women that have made the modern, more intelligent choice to tell their doctors or to go to their county health offices and say, no, you're going to give them in some kind of a sequence where they're separated. We give children way more inoculations and immunizations than just measles, mumps, and rubella.
Great. Thank you for your point, Jan. And I'm a mom. I've heard this argument from other mothers that the fact that so many of them are given it at once, there must be some sort of harm to the immune system that gets overloaded. And just briefly, because we have a lot of people wanting to talk to you, how would you respond to that concern, Dr. Dersey?
Well, a couple of things. One is, and I just want to correct something, it's measles, mumps, and rubella. So it is the regular measles and German measles. There is not any evidence that giving it sequentially is better for kids than giving it all at once. And it's given in such small quantities. Again, this is just an inoculation so that the immune system basically has a trial run with a small amount to be able to respond to it. So there isn't good evidence to show that spacing it out is better. Having said that, it's better to be immunized than not be immunized at all. So certainly, I think they should talk with their doctors about their doctor's view of that. But there's not good evidence now that spacing it out is any better. And in fact, especially for some of these highly infectious diseases, the sooner is the better.
Well, thank you so much for that that call. And we go next to Rick in Dodgeville. Hi, Rick.
Hi. So let me start off by saying this. I'm not a doctor, but I think I'm a fairly intelligent guy. I've got two master's degrees, and I've given this a lot of thought over the years, not just during the course of this show. I don't really buy into a lot of the things that the medical community, you know, puts out there, as well as politicians, just because they're doctors. I don't think they've cornered the market on all medical knowledge. And here's why. Because if you go back a little ways, a few hundred years, there was a point in time where bloodletting was considered irrefutable science. You go back even further than that, and you find diseases that existed and people thought that they were brought on because the gods were angry and that we should have that they should sacrifice their children in order for those diseases to for the gods to take those diseases away.
So, Rick, is the point you're getting to that science is fallible and that there may be more hazards to vaccines than we currently know about?
Absolutely. Science is absolutely fallible. And I think that 100 years from now, we may very well find 100 years from now that they look back at this point in time and they say, you guys actually thought that by injecting small amounts of viruses into your bodies that that was going to cure or prevent diseases, and they'll laugh at us.
Rick, thank you so much for that call. And Dr. Dersey, what do you say to that? Science is fallible. We may not have the whole picture yet.
So science is fallible. There's no question about that. However, science gets better. So there were a lot of theories about why people fell. The theory of gravity seems to work really well, and most of us kind of go, you know, I buy that theory. You know, like I think the scientists and the physicists are right about that particular theory. I mean, you know, we went to the moon on the basis of Newtonian physics, which has been pretty well established, and we pretty all accept it, although I have to tell you, it's just a theory, right? It's just a theory, and it happens to work well in practice. I think the scientific method is something that's come to the fore since the ages of bloodletting, and Hippocrates started us on Western medicine by saying, you know, it's not the gods. You're exactly right. It's physical causes. Let's try to find out the physical causes. So the reality is that we are on this scientific journey, but some things start looking pretty definite after a while. And again, I'm just using the theory of gravity as one in which we go, we accept that. You know, some days someone somehow might say there will be a better theory that explains everything. But right now, we're buying it, we're going with it. The scientific method actually decreased the number of people who have polio in the United States, decreased the number of kids who had measles, mumps, and rubella, and is curing a number of cancers, is helping people with heart disease. There's a lot of stuff that I think is being proven well. It is true that there may be things that we learn later on, and a number of them that haven't been subjected to the scientific method. It's because, you know, doctors always did that, and now we're looking and we're seeing, well, maybe antibiotics for that cold wasn't such a good idea because the cold is a virus. Antibiotics work against bacteria, and guess what? We need to just go with our scientific view that when you've got a virus, antibiotics are not going to help you.
And I'm just going to jump in here to make sure that we can get to another call there. Thank you for your call, Rick. Allie joins us next from Hudson. Hi, Allie.
Hi. I would just like to make a comment from, I guess, a social studies point of view. So when I think about vaccinization and participation in the community, I think that everybody has a responsibility to protect public health. So if you choose to participate in the public sphere, then you should have the responsibility to vaccinate your children.
Well, thank you so much for that comment, Allie. And we also have a Facebook comment from Kara who says, if my kid can't bring peanuts to school, your kid shouldn't be able to bring preventable illnesses. So as a final question to you, Dr. Dersey, is there an obligation, maybe even some sort of legislation, do you think needed or called for to encourage vaccination?
So I think we have an ethical obligation to protect the health of others that we're going to be encountering. When you are ill, you shouldn't be hanging out with people for whom you can give serious disease, no question about it. That ethical obligation is one that I think parents understood for years. I don't know that we're at the point at which legislation would be appropriate, although depending upon the rates of the infections and as they go up, people may actually clamor for it. They may say, we want to go back to the old days where this was a requirement and people understood the social obligation. If they don't, we're going to impose it. I don't know that those days are here yet, but I do have to say that the curve, you know, to go back to the exponential rate of these diseases, is at some point there will be enough people who go, this is enough, because if they're going to go to school with my children, they need to be vaccinated just as I've vaccinated my child.
Dr. Dersey, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate your time today.
Thank you, Veronica.
That was Dr. Art Dersey, director of the Center of Bioethics and Medical Humanities at the Medical College of Wisconsin.
Get up, stand up.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later in the show, we'll preview Governor Walker's budget address, which takes place at 7 p.m. tonight.
This week, we celebrate what would have been the 70th birthday of reggae legend and musical icon Bob Marley. His music is appreciated worldwide across generations, and his influence, musical and spiritual, continues to resonate today.
Whether we first heard Bob Marley in a dorm room or a shopping mall, many of us are familiar with his more popular songs like No Woman, No Cry, I Shot the Sheriff, or the song we're coming in with, Get Up, Stand Up. But a lot of us, including me, may not have heard the more complex, deeper cuts from his extensive catalog.
Well, here with us to share some of his favorite lesser-known Bob Marley songs is DJ FRP, host of Tropical Rhythms on WORT in Madison. DJ FRP, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, both of you. Thank you so much. It's really nice to be able to celebrate or kick off this Bob Marley birthday month, I'd like to call it.
The whole month.
Well, I'll be celebrating the rest of this week with some performances and, of course, kicking things off with this week's Central Time.
So what is it about Bob Marley's music that resonates across generations and continues to inspire us so long after his passing?
No, I've heard so many different stories from people who call me up during my show and during the tributes that I've had over the last 23 years to Bob Marley's music, and raising the children and how calming it is for children to listen to it, and how even some parents of autistic children have just sat back and relaxed to the sounds of Bob Marley. So that's just one of the effects there. Of course, there's also the lyrics that are not interpreted by people who don't understand English throughout the world, but knew that there was a message coming through this man's emotion and in the sound of the music, and how it's resonated with people all over the world. It's a mystery to me as well.
And he did so much music. There's so much out there, and he had such an influence, and yet he died at age 36.
Yeah.
How did he pack so much into that fairly short life?
Well, Jamaican musicians are, shall we say, notorious for recording music and putting it out. I mean, there's artists that will release a song, it seems like a song a day. he had quite a few recordings, starting when he was a teenager in 1962, when he first recorded Judge Not, and finished 18 years later with his last performance of Get Up, Stand Up and Work, which was recorded at a live performance in Pittsburgh.
Now, in terms of some of the lesser-known Marley songs, there's one, Selassie is the Chapel. Let's take a listen before we talk about it.
Take your troubles to Selassie. Oh, is the only
to reference her, I'm guessing, to Ethiopian Emperor Haile Selassie. What's the connection between Bob Marley and Haile Selassie?
Well, right around this period, which was June 8, 1968, Bob Marley was reasoning with Rastafarians, in particular Mortimer Plano, who produced this song, and prophecy revealed that the Messiah would return and would be crowned in Africa. And lo and behold, during this time period, Haile Selassie, Rastafari, was born, and this was living proof of the Bible that they were following and studying at the time. The interesting thing about this particular song, I think, and what makes it particularly unique, it was modeled after a country and western song that was first recorded, that was in the 1950s. Yeah, Rex Allen, country artist, popularized the song, and then the Orioles recorded it as well in the 50s, and so did Elvis Presley. Crying in the Chapel is what it's based on. Nice Nyabingi drums coming through, and not uncommon to hear Rastafarians reason to the drums.
And I think in my head, when I think of world music from anywhere in the world, I think of this country having its own thing and this country having its own thing. But I guess when you look at reggae music and many other forms, there's this constant like conversation between the Caribbean and the United States and soul music and rhythm and blues. How much back and forth was that for a performer like Bob Marley?
Well, Bob Marley did, of course, come to the United States as an immigrant to work. But before him, there were Jamaicans that would come to the United States and would take back music, of course, to play. But more importantly, everyone had a transistor radio during the time when Bob was growing up. And it wasn't uncommon for AM stations in the United States to boost their signal late at night. So the sounds from New Orleans and the sounds from Nashville were not uncommon. And it's still to this day, there's artists that are re-recording country songs from back in the day, or country and western, not just country songs, but country and western songs from back in the day. Of course, they were, you know, being brought up by their parents who played these songs and loved and sang to them. And so these songs and music resonated with Jamaicans.
Now, you mentioned Rastafarians, and Marley, I guess, converted is the right word at one point to become a Rastafarian himself. Can you tell us a little bit about what that is and how it influenced his music?
Well, it's a deep spiritual thing. You could ask that to anyone who is religious or spiritual, and gospel singers in particular. What is it that makes you want to write songs that will resonate with others, with other individuals, and how that music affects one? That's a personal thing.
Well, I want to check out another one of the songs we're going to talk about. This one is Soul Rebel, a collaboration, I gather, with the reggae producer Lee Scratch Perry. Let's give a listen.
See the morning sun. See the morning sun. On the hillside.
Yeah.
If you're not living good, gotta travel wide. You gotta travel wide. Said I'm a living man.
So Lee Scratch Perry, a name I've heard a lot, a legend. For people who know what they're talking about, I don't know his work that much. Can you talk about him and his influence on Bob Marley?
Well, Lee started out as a young youth as a dancer, and would run records when records were pressed, and had his initial start with Studio One, and that's where the paths were initially crossed. Musicians in Jamaica would know of each other. Lee Perry did not start out with Bob Marley during the early part of his career. Bob had some things going on, and in fact he wrote this song in 1968 and didn't cross paths worked with Lee Perry until 1970, when this song was re-recorded. I mean, there's numerous versions of this one. This is my particular favorite because of how Lee Perry rearranged the vocals and has Peter Tosh singing those really low notes, and of course the horn section that's on there. You won't find that on any of the other earlier recordings. But this was a pivotal period during Bob Marley's life when he was, coming from the ska scene into something that was called rock steady, which Aretha Franklin sang about. This was just the beginning of reggae music coming out in the late 60s, so what we know as reggae music. So this was huge as far as working with Lee Scratch Perry, who went on to do incredible work on his own. We can do another two-hour tribute to him and just scratch the surface.
We'll go next to a live version of the song Burnin' and Lootin', which is taken from a soon-to-be-released live album. Mm-hmm. What can you tell us before we listen about this song?
Well, this is a Central Time exclusive. This hasn't been played on the Wisconsin airwaves. I actually talked over it last week during my show. So you'll be playing this for the first time. But this is an extraordinary recording. Some say it might be the best live recording or best production of Bob Marley's music since the 1975 live version. And what makes this particular song resonate with me, even though many of you have heard this before, Burnin' and Lootin' the song, is that this song was recorded only 2 weeks after he had performed at the Orpheum Theater here in Madison, Wisconsin, which I had the opportunity to see. So this song is as close to the experience that I had listening to him perform it live for the first time.
How many rivers do we have to cross before we can talk to the boss? All we got is seeing we have lost. We must have really hit our course.
So an exclusive there of a soon-to-be-released live album of Bob Marley music. You saw him live. What was it like? What was the experience like that's different from those of us just hearing him on albums?
Words can't describe it. Speechless. It was a deeply emotional experience for me. I had never been to a performance or heard music that would make me cry, and that was the first time that ever happened to me.
Wow.
And when something like that touches you, it's unforgettable.
He had a real physical style too on stage that was kind of unmistakable.
Yeah, he was and dare we say at points in time he would just be overcome by the music and become a whirling dervish, and on the other hand he would just go over gently to his backup singers and put his arms around them and sing with them in unison, and playing drums and just sit down. So there was this rhythm that would happen from the beginning up until the climactic end.
We mark the 70th birthday of Bob Marley, new material still, live material still being released. We can keep revisiting his work even today.
Absolutely. In this particular package, this live version, Easy Skankin' in Boston, which is scheduled to be released on the 17th, will also include a 45-minute video as well as some animation that fits in with this. And this will give us an idea of what it was like when he performed here in Madison back in 78.
Oh, thank you so much for joining us today to talk about it.
Thank you for having me, Veronica.
We've been speaking with DJ FRP, the host of Tropical Rhythms on WORT in Madison.